The year is 2000. Our scene is the office of a recreational youth center in a suburban area of Los Angeles.
Good morning. I'm Thomas Peck. I'm looking for Dr. Talbot.
I'm Dr. Talbot. Oh, you're the writer from International Magazine. I've been expecting you.
Thank you. Until my photographer arrives, Dr. Talbot, I wonder if you'd brief me on the history of the center.
Of course. Please sit down, Mr. Peck, while I close the door.
Thank you.
As you know, there are now youth centers all across America. Our purpose is to help guide our young people into channels of constructive thought and action.
I know I'm interrupting, but, aren't the public schools doing this?
In an academic way, yes. But I'm talking about the development of the personality. It's those long hours spent off the school grounds that we're interested in.
I see.
You asked about the history of our recreational centers, Mr. Peck. Let's look at the year 1960. At that time, a new leisure was upon the land.
Yes, I remember reading about it. It began after World War II, I believe.
Yes, that's right. This new leisure was due to several things. Termination of the war, an expanding economy, the advent of television and so forth. But the point is this. The young people of our country were left to themselves for the most part. This period marked the beginning of the end.
The end? The end of what?
The end of family activities as interlocking, overlapping fields of interest.
But didn't I read somewhere that the password in 1960 was togetherness?
Yes, but it wasn't true. Togetherness was merely a concept to which more lip service was paid than to anything else. Perhaps the term was invented because of a vague realization that togetherness was the one thing which our society was losing.
Well, that's very interesting.
But getting back to the young people, what happened to them? In too many instances, they were utterly lost, left to themselves by busy parents. They tended to band together with a natural result that the group action replaced individual thought.
Yes, I've seen some of the results of that dilemma.
So what happened? Recreational centers such as this one were born. Places where young people can learn to know themselves, to know others, to know their environment, and how to express themselves in that environment. These are not easy things.
What about the youth who has serious emotional problems?
Well, of course, we can give him the best possible help. Our psychiatric staff is extensive, as you will find in most...
Another possible achievement by the year 2000. Guided emotional development for the young in recreational youth centers. Dr. Stafford Warren, dean of the UCLA School of Medicine, says...
By the year 2000, it may long since have been forgotten that back in 1960... the leading cause of disability in the United States was mental and emotional disorders. Indeed, such astonishing progress will have been made in understanding the mind that the very idea that a tenth of our population once suffered from mental illness will seem symptomatic of the Dark Ages. By the year 2000, a mental and emotional checkup will be an accepted and valuable part of any routine medical examination.
The year is 2000. The setting, California's massive space base, where KNX reporter Edward P. Marlowe is about to hit the air with a broadcast.
Good evening. The news of the moment is that the United States has just sent a man on his way to the planet Mars. 35-year-old Colonel Howard Stopp. Here at the launching site, we are receiving a direct picture of the space vehicle interior. I can see that the Colonel has just regained consciousness from the effects of launching. Standing beside me is Major General Hiram Welch, public information officer for this operation. General Welch, how serious was that blackout experienced by Colonel Stopp?
Well, not serious at all, Ed. As you know, the Colonel's been through this before on his first moon trip, for instance.
Yes, I remember.
I'd say he lost consciousness when his ship reached a force of 9G.
And G is the force of acceleration.
That's right, Ed. A man in a pressure suit can stand a force of 12G for 6 seconds, but it's rather uncomfortable. As you can see on the screen here, Colonel Stopp is now wide awake and is taking over some of the controls.
But I thought you controlled the spacecraft from here.
Oh, we can, of course, and in fact we will if the Colonel shows any sign of faltering. But you must remember, Ed, that the point of this whole thing is not to investigate Mars. After all, we did that last year with an unmanned reconnaissance satellite.
Yes, I recall you settled the question once and for all about those canals on Mars.
Yes, that was a relief, wasn't it? Well, anyway, man is either capable of space evolution or he isn't. This experiment should answer that question.
What specifically are you looking for, General?
Well, this is a test for medicine, or perhaps a psychology of outer space. Here's one specific. Can Colonel Stop survive zero gravity?
Why, is there any doubt?
Well, if you can visualize this, Ed, a man in free flight or zero gravity has no forces acting on his body. If he isn't strapped to his chair, he'll float all over the cabin. And psychologically, this is bad because he won't know whether he's up or down. This may be amusing on a short space flight, but after a month of this, real trouble sets in.
What is that?
From sheer fatigue, he'll stop caring where he is. His reasoning powers may be destroyed. And then, of course, he's useless.
I see what you mean. What else are you looking for?
Well, his ability to detect trouble. We don't pretend there won't be equipment failure. But the question is, will he have the presence of mind to recognize and cope with it?
Can you give me an example, General?
Of course. As you know, a space pilot has a supply of oxygen for breathing. What happens to the carbon dioxide he exhales? If it isn't carried away by filtering, he'll suffocate. Now, last year, when Colonel Stopp was on his way to the moon, his filtering system failed, and the carbon dioxide built up to a dangerous 4%, and he began making errors in judgment. He happily reported his breathing rate as 44, when actually it was 17.
What happened?
Well, luckily, he responded to our radio instruction to pour on more oxygen.
Lucky indeed. I see you're being paid, General. Thank you for giving your time.
Well, not at all, Ed. Good night.
The advancement in space medicine, which will aid the doctors in the year 2000, is just one phase of medical progress. As we move on into the future, the part played by medical science will be of increasing importance in our lives. Dr. Stafford Warren, Dean of the School of Medicine at the University of California at Los Angeles, has this to say in that regard.
Study and research in space medicine is just one small area to be examined in the future of medicine. Many of these studies will be useful in medicine as a whole. Undoubtedly, the day lies ahead when a medical checkup will include extensive medical as well as physical tests, just as has been done for the man in the space capsule. If the results of such examinations can be promptly applied, I'm sure we'll see a great many favorable changes take place in the problem social areas of the population, such as those that involve the criminal element, broken homes, and adaptability to social environment. Indeed, such astonishing progress will have been made in understanding the human mind and its reactions that the thought that a tenth of the nation's population once suffered from mental illnesses will seem symptomatic of the Dark Ages.
The year is 2000, and the scene, a court of international law in Santa Barbara, California.
Good evening. This is KNX reporter Edward P. Marlowe. The argument done on the floor of the court became very much overheated this afternoon because the delegates could not agree on what space is or where it is. So the assembly has broken up into caucuses to discuss these various aspects. I'm going to switch now down to room 103, where a microphone will pick up a discussion on the boundaries of space.
Gentlemen, let me make my point quite clear. I insist that there is a definite amount of space over every territory on Earth, and that space which exists over my country belongs to my country.
My good Mr. Carr, I am afraid you do not understand the problem at all. Of course, there is space over every country on Earth, but it is not the same piece of space from one moment to the next. Yes.
I don't know about your country, Mr. Lebec, but I can assure you there is always space over my country, and it is our sovereign possession.
Is that so? Has it occurred to you that as the Earth turns, it goes through different areas of space from one moment to the next? Surely your country does not own all the space it travels through.
In that case, we must consider that space is turning right along with the Earth.
Impossible.
Yeah, gentlemen! Please! My name is Colonel Martin Brown of Edwards Air Base here in Southern California. And may I say that Mr. Lebec has a valid point. Space is quite stationary, and we are moving through it.
I object.
Otherwise, if you insist that space is turning with the Earth, just as a technical convenience, think what would happen on another planet, or even on the moon.
I quite agree.
Someone standing on the moon will have various pieces of space passing over his head as the distant Earth continues to turn. At one moment, his sky will be owned by Japan. The next moment by Pakistan, then Italy, the United States.
Yes, oh, that's preposterous. My wife would never hear of it.
This is Ed Marlowe back in the booth. Apparently, it's a stalemate in room 103. So let's switch now to room 500, where another caucus is in session. They are discussing the legal aspects of an Earth satellite of one country passing over the territories of other countries.
And so, gentlemen, even though you all keep referring to the time-honored right of innocent passage, I still say that our islands strongly object to a satellite of another country passing overhead. It is a legal violation of our sovereignty. However, we are not objecting because you are putting something into space, but just keep it over your own territory, not ours.
Now, Mr. Marduk, am I to understand that you would have no objection if we could put an object into space over Los Angeles that had the ability to remain suspended over the Earth without going around it?
No objection whatever.
But you must remember that the Earth would continue to turn beneath this so-called stationary object.
Well, if that is what you mean...
So, for all practical purposes, this stationary object would appear to be passing over your country anyhow. Would you object to that?
I most certainly would.
In that case, I submit that what you are objecting to is the turning of the Earth.
Does such a controversy in a court of law sound far-fetched? Perhaps it's not so much so at that. As Dr. Robert Kingsley, Dean of the School of Law at the University of Southern California, explains it...
With the opening up of space, an entire new area of international and even of interstellar law may have to be established. However, past experience with new situations suggests that the new law of space will be more an application of traditional principles and concepts than the creation of an entirely new system of legal ideas. There seems little doubt that legal procedure in general will undergo a great change. More laws and more lawyers will be the trend. Increased technical advances will call for increased regulations. And tomorrow's attorney may find that his library consists of vast files of microfilm and a viewer. Rehabilitation procedures will be greatly accelerated, and possibly the prison system may include a sort of halfway house where prisoners return in the evening from work during the daylight hours. Law and legal institutions will change. Exactly how is obviously beyond specific prediction. On the directions taken by the society of the future will depend the exact answer.
The year 2000, and you are listening to the full-range radio programming of station KNX. Time now to hear the report of one of the world's leading authorities on women's fashions, Miss Marjorie Karn.
Los Angeles is buzzing with excitement as fashion editors from all the major cities of the world assemble, and speculation turns to the question, will the pants line be up or down this year? Los Angeles, of course, is the unquestioned fashion center of the world, and the ordinary dress, as grandmother used to know it in the 60s, seems as old-fashioned as the bustle did 40 years ago. Of course, pants come in great varieties. Christian Loper, for instance, features softly pleated knee pants in paper silk for afternoon, and a very practical traveling ensemble, a tailored, lightweight, synthetic flannel suit with a slim, slit skirt over the tapered leg sleeves. Generally, for the woman's busy day at the office or attending the many meetings she will be called on to attend, J.W. Maybachs will set the pace with their line of day uniforms, shirtmaker knee pants in assorted fabrics and colors, but with little variety in style. This eliminates all that senseless, time-wasting pondering over what to wear when a woman is hurrying to get off in the morning. The biggest designer story, as always, is the after-five and formal clothes line. Some creations featuring pants under slit skirts, but nevertheless, all displaying the perennial trademark of feminine creatures, skirts. The fashion cycles of the past 100 years will continue to be repeated, with variations such as the skillfully engineered deep plunge neckline. All fabrics, from the paper cottons to the synthetic laces and chiffons, will be lightweight, drip-dry, and non-creasable. Synthetic furs are very popular again this year, and the synthetic mink that the well-dressed lady will wear about as long as she used to wear a cloth coat 40 years ago will be much more elegant appearing than the $10,000 blue mist mink Aunt Maud persists in keeping under lock and key in the cedar chest.
Sound too fantastic to be true? Not according to Marjorie Carn. Miss Carn, in this, the year 1960, is fashion coordinator for the California Fashion Creators. And Marjorie says,
with the organized day, the increase in participating sports due to the shorter work week, and the neighborhood athletic bars, the women of the year 2000 will be nothing but slim, slim, slim. Many will think it normal to wear a size 3, and if a girl takes a size 14, she won't tell anybody. In fabrics, the paper materials will be extremely popular in the lower-priced garments, and many high-fashion evening designs will be copied in paper. This will mean that a woman can feel free just to drop the dress in the waste disposal after a couple of wearings. All the fashions of the year 2000 will be highly suited to traveling, with the different pant styles and the soft, non-crushable fabrics. And the designers will feature their high-fashion travel kits, 12-piece packets that will meet the weight requirements of the rocket lines and take the ladies from morning through night wherever they go.
The year is 2000. Our setting, the futuristic office living quarters of a prominent Southland physician.
Oh, wouldn't you know it? Always somebody's ringing the phono screen when you're in the middle of something. Oh, it's you, Mr. Castle.
Yes, Mr. Onsen. Is the doctor in?
No, she isn't. Did you have an appointment?
I'm afraid not, but I had a couple of questions about Junior's rash.
Well, doesn't her recorded encyclopedia of infant care cover it?
Oh, well, isn't that just like... I didn't even think of that.
Well, look, Mr. Castle, if you don't find it there, I'll pencil you in for a 10:30 appointment tomorrow morning. That's before office hours, but for you...
Well, thank you.
It's all right. It'll give me a chance to talk to you about a new dual premium life insurance policy my company's introducing.
Yes. Well, I'll see if I can't find the answer on the record. Bye.
Well, that's the way the old rocket orbits.
Hi.
Oh, hello, sugar. All I can say is that a doctor's life is rough.
You don't say.
Yeah, if it isn't Mr. Castle calling for an appointment, it's some guy wanting a home cure for hangnail. I've been trying to spend a quiet day here at home installing this electronic chef.
Oh, you poor
dear. And
that
plastic phono screen's been going constantly. Hey, by the way, you didn't kiss me.
Well, you knew that there's no private life for a doctor when we got married.
Yeah, but there are limits. Say, do I get a kiss or don't I?
Oh, I'm sorry, darling. Of course you do.
Well, that's more like it. You know, as a doctor, you shouldn't forget your bedside manner.
Oh, is that so? Well, as an insurance salesman, you're awfully fresh.
All right. Now.
What's for dinner?
Well, if I get this thing working, we'll have soybean steak. Look, sugar, Mr. Castle wants an appointment at 9 tomorrow. He says you're the only doctor he'll talk to. All the others treat him like a baby.
Professional equality. That's just one way the differences between men and women may be minimized by the year 2000. And a professional equality will mean the emergence of equal standards for both man and wife in the home. And to cope with new problems will be numerous marriage counselors, according to Dr. Paul Papineau, president of the American Institute of Family Relations.
That's right. In the year 2000, there will be many more marriage counselors, and couples will go to them for help as readily with a faulty marriage as they go to have their jet helicopter, air conditioner, or rheumatism fixed. Consequently, the marriage partnership will be a more meaningful and lasting institution than it is now. This doesn't mean, however, that there wouldn't be new problems and a lot of the same old ones in the field of domestic relations. And undoubtedly, there will be some failures caused by, well, who knows?
Sure, I can talk about it. Before we were married, Ruth and I passed every test for compatibility, but she's a specialist doing important research, and I design pulse circuits, intellect all over the place. But we ran into a language barrier we couldn't break. She's so highly trained that her vocabulary became narrow. And it was the same way with me. We couldn't understand each other. We forgot how to say those simple things which brought us together in the first place.
And again, in the year 2000...
we had one basic difference that couldn't be overcome. He thought it was important that we develop similar tastes. But I insisted, and I always shall, that the important thing is to adapt to your partner's different tastes. It was hopeless.
But marriage in the year 2000 has a much more optimistic side as well.
Greater leisure time should prove to be a boon to family life, and even though domestic jobs, such as raising the children and cleaning the house, may be shared on a 50-50 basis, additional time and labor-saving innovations will take the strain out of this area. Important, too, is the fact that in addition to more time for togetherness, there will be more time for individual family members to pursue their own hobbies and interests. This in itself will give more fullness, a more well-rounded aspect to the family circle.
Thank you, Dr. Papineau. The year is 2000. The setting, a typical ranch house of the time. The automatic maid has just cleared the table of the disposable breakfast dishes, and the day is getting underway.
More coffee, Pa.
No, thanks, Etta. Reckon I better be getting out to the back porch.
What is it, the fence again?
Yeah. She sprung another leak. Gotta get her plugged before the stock dies off.
I don't know why I ever let you talk me into becoming a rancher's wife.
Now, Hattie, at least it ain't like it used to be when ranches had all them cattle roaming about. Halibuts are a lot easier to take care of.
Yeah, well, I suppose. I remember driving by one of them old-fashioned cattle ranches when I was a girl. My, they certainly was dusty places.
Yeah. Me for a fish farm every time. You know what to say, fish farming is good for the soul.
You and your crummy puns. Next time you pull that corny line or the one about people said I was all wet when I took up fish farming. Honestly, I think I'll go right into orbit.
Now, Hetty, don't get all...
Don't you dare. Waldo, if you call me Head Up Hetty again just once more, I swear I'm going to just...
Yes. Well, sir, I reckon I'd better be getting out at that fence. Say, did I mention I thought I might stock the West Fish Pasture with golden trout come next spring?
Paw, last time you tried that, you said you'd never do it again.
Well, if you'd tell them grandchildren of yours quit swimming in the pasture, things would be different. You know that upsets the fish.
Oh, now, Pa, they didn't do no harm.
No harm? There's nothing worse than the traumatic trout.
Oh, sure, Pa.
This time I got myself an idea. You know, there was a fella on the radio the other day, the Fish Farmer's Hour.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, well, he was telling about some new fish vitamins. They'll get a trout up to about 30 or 40 pounds in 1 year.
Now, that Mackininch fella.
Yes, that's the one. Also, somebody came up with the idea of sending light electric shocks through the water. Claims it goads the fish into eating more. Say, you know, I'd like to try that.
Well, then you get an expert to hook it up for you. You know how you are with things like that.
Now, listen to me, Hattie.
Listen, like that time I asked you to fix my breakfast server for me. For the next 3 weeks, any time someone appeared before the front door video viewer, there'd be toast all over the kitchen. Buttered.
Well, I gotta admit it did come in handy for between meal snacks.
Yeah. Well, if you're going to fix that fence before all the water runs out, you better get started.
Yeah, I guess you're right there.
And be sure you dry your feet when you come back in. Oh, leave it to that man and he'd have the house looking like Pismo Beach at high tide.
Sound fantastic? Well, such a situation might not be so far-fetched as you might think. Not according to Dr. Lucian Bavetta of the Department of Biochemistry at the University of Southern California.
At the rate the world's population is increasing, it will not be long until the land now being used for grazing will be much too valuable for such purposes. Man will become less and less dependent on animal tissues for a source of food, and he will have to place more emphasis to plant foods in the diet. Fish and seafood will become more important in the daily manuals. Consequently, the raising of fish will become a vital profit-producing industry. But however, in order that schools of fish may be controlled, it is conceivable that man-made lakes will have to be built, since fish cannot be raised with a high degree of efficiency in the ocean depths. Now, this principle, which we have been discussing, in no way conflicts with the conclusion that cattle or sheep ranching is wasteful of the land. It is a luxury which we will be less and less able to afford as the years go by. The facts are that man can raise more good protein in an acre of water than he can on an acre of land.